I'm going to ask you this evening to open in your Bibles to the 8th chapter of the book of Ezekiel. Ezekiel chapter 8, we've been averaging about a chapter a week. Which has been good, and hoping to get through of this 8th chapter. There's one problem, and that is chapter 8 is intimately connected to chapters 9, 10, and into chapter 11. Perhaps you're going to note that in verse 5 of chapter 8, we see that he said to me, Son of Man, I'm sorry. Back it up. You have the vision of the one who has the form, the appearance of a man in verse 2. And in verse 3, it's this figure who is also very likened to the one that was upon the throne in chapter 1. The visions of God we have in chapter 1. Here's the throned one who is without the chariot throne. But he disappears in the brilliance of the light and glory that Ezekiel saw him in chapter 1. The appearance of brightness, gleaming metal that we saw in chapter 1. We read how the form of a hand took me by the lock of my head, and the Spirit lifted me up from the earth and heaven and brought me in the visions of God. This is being the visions of God. This is going to be some vision he's going to experience while in Babylon, but it's going to be just as if he was in the very city of Jerusalem, seeing these events around the temple and the ultimate destruction of the city he's also going to see. So basically in chapters 8, 9, and 10, we see not only the destruction of the temple, but we see the reason for it. We see the idolatry of Israel really played out in very vivid terms. So God makes it very clear as to why he brings the judgment upon this nation. And also, not only does God judge the nation with the Babylonians coming and killing multitudes and many being brought into captivity, but God himself leaves the temple. God himself and the chariot throne. The chariot throne in chapter 1 is going to make its reappearance, particularly in chapter 10. And the glory of the Lord is going to leave the temple. Go out with the exiles in Babylon. At least Ezekiel saw that vision in chapter 1. The Lord leaves the temple. And then in chapter 11, you see that the God who lifted him up and took him into visions of God to Jerusalem, in verse 22, at the end of chapter 11, we read, Then the cherubim lifted up their wings and with the wheels beside them, and the glory of the God of Israel was over them. And the glory of the Lord went up from the midst. And then verse 24, the Spirit lifted me up and brought me in the vision by the Spirit of God into Chaldea. So he's going back to Jerusalem. All of the visions of God. And they're really having left Jerusalem. A very, very interesting, unprecedented type of vision that Ezekiel receives here. Being transported from where he was amongst the exiles in Babylon into the city of Jerusalem to see these visions. And then to be transported back, all in this visionary dream. I shouldn't say dream, so he probably was not sleeping, but in this vision that he saw. Now, let me just read the 8th chapter to you, and then we'll just look to dissect a bit of it. We've given the second of the time references, or actually the third, there's two in chapter 1. But here we find about 14 months have elapsed from the time that Ezekiel received the vision and call of God in chapter 1. And so back then it was the fifth year, but now it's become the sixth year. And it's in the sixth month, on the fifth day of the month, as I sat in my house with the eldest of Judah sitting before me. He's still in his house. And probably he's accomplished all those things God told him to do in chapters 4 and 5. And now there's a new thing. Chapters 6 and 7, I guess, as well. Prophesying to the mountains, and then speaking of the wrath of the day of the Lord in chapter 7. But now in chapter 8, he's still in the house, and the elders of Judah are sitting before him. We have a couple of mentions later on in chapter 14 and verse 1, I believe it is, chapter 42 and verse 1, of the elders of the people coming to Ezekiel in his home, and they come for the purpose of seeking counsel from the Lord. And so they probably have come looking for some form of counsel, maybe giving some insight into what's going to happen to them in their exile. Are they going back home, as they hoped? And Ezekiel, at that very point, is given this vision with reference to the city of Jerusalem and the ultimate destruction of the city and the ultimate exile of the remaining people that do remain back home. And so it's as he's in his house with the elders of Judah sitting before him that we read, "The hand of the Lord God fell upon me there." Now, most often the hand of the Lord comes upon him, but now the hand of the Lord falls upon him. A little bit more forceful manifestation of God's hand upon him. And then we read in verse 2, "Then I looked, and behold, a form that had the appearance of a man. Below what appeared to be his waist was fire, and above his waist was something like the appearance of brightness like gleaming metal." That's the point that's emphasized in chapter 1, the one on the throne, that above his waist there was that appearance like gleaming metal. And we read, "He put out the form of a hand and took me by a lock of my head. Spirit lifted me up between earth and heaven and brought me into visions of God to Jerusalem, to the entrance of the gateway of the inner court that faces north, where the seat of the image of jealousy, which provokes to jealousy, and behold, the glory of the God of Israel was there, like the vision that I saw in the valley." So this one with brightness of appearance, like gleaming metal, who accompanies him in this vision into Jerusalem, is concerned to show him various things in the precincts of the temple, both in the outward court. He told him to look to the north and to see that image of jealousy that provokes the jealousy. And now he can tell him more what he's supposed to be doing. Verse 5. And it's almost like the one who's appearing to him and taking him in vision to Jerusalem is now going to take him on a tour of the temple and its precincts. "He said to me, Son of man, lift up your eyes now toward the north. So I lifted up my eyes toward the north, and behold, north of the altar gate in the entrance," that is in the entrance into the into the court and probably into the temple, "there was this image of jealousy. And he said to me, Son of man, do you see what they are doing? The great abominations that the house of Israel are committing here to drive me far from my sanctuary. But you will see greater abominations." And that's a note that you're going to see a couple of times. God's going to show him things that are horrific, they're abominations, and yet greater abominations are yet to come. And then we read, "He brought me to the entrance of the court, and when I looked, behold, there was a hole in the wall. And then he said to me, Son of man, dig in the wall." So there's a hole to begin to dig, and he goes to make the hole bigger. And he digs in the wall, and behold, there was an entrance. And he said to me, "Go in." So he digs a hole large enough for himself to go in. And this is in vision. "See the vile abominations that they are committing here." And so there was stuff going on in the outer court. It was abominations. Now he's going into the temple itself. It probably wasn't the main rooms. It probably was some off rooms that he sees at first. Eventually, in chapter 10, he's going to get into the Holy of Holies. But in the increasing ways, he's moving towards the sacred space, the holy space, where there were rules as to who could go in and what could be done. And what he sees there are simply one abomination after another, one symbol of idolatry after another. "I dug in the wall," it says, "and behold, there was an entrance, and he said to me, go in and see the vile abominations they are committing here. So I went in and saw, and there engraved on the wall all around was every form of creeping things and loathsome beasts and all the idols of the house of Israel." So you have all kinds of unclean animals that were portrayed there in symbol, again, the things that the Gentiles worshipped, that the nations worshipped, and all these idols that were being worshipped by the people of Israel. "And before them stood 70 men of the elders of the house of Israel, with Jezaniah, the son of Shaphan, standing among them. Each had his censer in his hand, and the smoke of the cloud of incense went up. And he said to me, Son of man, have you seen what the elders of the house of Israel are doing in the dark, each in his room of pictures? For they say, Yahweh does not see us. Yahweh has forsaken the land. He has also said to me, you will see greater abominations that they commit." So we have two pictures thus far. Now we have a third in verse 14. "Then he brought me to the entrance of the north gate of the house of Yahweh, and behold, there sat women weeping for Tammuz. You say, what in the world is that? That's a good question. When you figure it out, you come and tell me, and we'll go and set the theological world on fire because you're getting an insight that very few have. I'm not really sure what this is, but it has some kind of connection with weeping, perhaps mourning for the dead, and some form of pagan practice that came, again, not from the Torah, not from God's law, but from the practices of the nations. And he said to me, have you seen this, O son of man? You will see still greater abominations than these. Very likely some kind of communication with the dead took place in this weeping for Tammuz, as it's called. And he brought me into the inner court of the house of Yahweh, and behold, at the entrance of the temple of Yahweh, between the porch and the altar, were about 25 men with their backs to the temple of Yahweh and their faces toward the east, worshiping the sun toward the east. And he said to me, have you seen this? O son of man, is it too light a thing for the house of Judah to commit the abominations that they commit here, that they should fill the land with violence and provoke me still further to anger? Behold, they put the branch to their nose, and therefore I will act in wrath. My eye will not spare, nor will I have pity. Though they cry in my ears with a loud voice, I will not hear them. So 14 months have gone by. Ezekiel has done the things God told him to do with respect to picturing the siege of Jerusalem, with respect to showing the famine rations and eating those rations that were typical of a people under siege and under famine as a result of war. He has been given to prophesy to the mountains with reference to the sins of the nation with regard to worship that took place in altars that were not prescribed by God on the high, in the high places. And then he speaks about the day of the wrath of the Lord that would come upon the people, and to sound the trumpet and to speak to the issue of the sins that will bring about disaster upon disaster upon the nation. And now he's being brought into a new set of visions, a new set of visions that very vividly is going to set before Ezekiel the fact of God's judgment upon the city of Jerusalem, of God's judgment upon the temple, God himself up and leaving the temple, his glory no longer being manifest in the temple, and of the great destruction that will befall the city by the invading armies of the Babylonians. And you know, before he saw it in the quiet and peace of his home, he saw it in terms of being very immobile, in a sense, lying on the side for 390 days and 40 days, and depicting these things in these symbols that God gave him to do. And now there's a much more active picture. He's actually going to be in the visions of God in the temple. I don't know how that was done, but God did it. Again, I don't think he left this. I don't think he left Babylon. I don't think people in Jerusalem were going to welcome some manifestation of Ezekiel as he came into the temple precincts. Again, this is said to be done in the visions of God. It's God lifting him up, and God taking him by the lock of his head and lifting him up between earth and heaven and bringing him in a visionary way to Jerusalem to see the temple, and then to be brought on a tour of the temple by the Lord who guided him. God tells him exactly what he was to do. First of all, outside in the courtyard, he was to lift up his eyes toward the north. Again, he came towards the gateway that was the northern gateway. You know the significance of the northern gateway, don't you? You know the significance of the north in general? That's where the invading armies would come when Israel was conquered. They came but via the north, from the north of Syria. Didn't go come through the Jordan. They came down the mountains, down the Golan Heights, it's called, down into the valleys, and then sacked the cities in the north and took them captive, and ultimately would come into the city of Jerusalem. And such a procedure happened, of course, in the days of the Assyrians. coming right up to the city gates. And then God worked a great deliverance through King Hezekiah and his prayers, his faith, bringing God to destroy the armies of Sennacherib. And no doubt the exiles were expecting something similar was going to happen. That though the armies of the Babylonians had come down the very same way that the Assyrians had come, and there were groups of exiles taken into captivity, that this would be short-lived, that this would be something God would overturn in answer to the prayers of his people. And one of the things this passage tells us is God's done hearing prayers that are simply asking for deliverance. The passage ends with God's acting in wrath, saying, "My eye will not spare. I will not have pity. Though they cry in my ears with a loud voice, I will not hear them." This is the hour of judgment. This is the hour when the nation is going to be destroyed and sent into captivity, at least the exiles will be let out of the city in chains into Babylon, at least for a period of 70 years. And only then would there be a remnant that would return. And when you think of the great destruction that is still to come, I think at this point you're probably a good 6 or 7 years before the Babylonians actually bring the final devastating blow to the city, before the temple actually does fall, before the last group of exiles are brought out into Babylon. And this is a vision that's basically showing Ezekiel why God is addressed the nation with such ferocity, with such harshness. Why doesn't he relent? Why doesn't he spare? Why doesn't he hear the voice of the people crying out for mercy? Has God forgotten to be merciful? No, but this is the hour of his wrath. This is the hour when the full weight of transgression that the nation has committed throughout the centuries, in every violation of his laws, is now going to be met upon this generation. And God's going to start anew with a new generation of exiles that would return, of a remnant that would return. But he's not going to spare them. And here's a passage that tells us exactly the lengths to which the nation went in their sins, particularly in their sins of idolatry. Ezekiel is shown four aspects of idolatrous activity that the nation is guilty of. And it seems it goes from bad to worse. There's that constant refrain after each one of these episodes where he's told, "You will see still greater abominations." You think this is bad? You've not seen anything yet. Here's now what they've done even further. And it does seem that what is being depicted, what is being portrayed, is acts of idolatry that take place in different sectors of the holy space. Outside in the courtyard, inside the building structure itself, coming into the very holy place. In chapter 10, you're in the Holy of Holies and things that are happening there. And so with increasing penetration into the holy things of the temple, you find the penetration of idolatrous actions, of idolatrous practices on the part of the people of Israel. And probably the severity of the crimes, the greater of abominations that are being committed, is in relationship to how the people are just simply indifferent to everything God says is to be set apart to himself as holy. And they just simply trample upon all of those requirements given to the nation, bringing in every man, every imaginable kind of idolatrous practice. And it's also likely that these idolatrous practices represent idolatrous practices from various nations that surrounded them. One other thing God made clear in the law was you're not to do the practices or keep the practices of the Egyptians, from which God redeemed them, or from the Canaanites. That was the nation that was going to be that they were to supplant. And the idolatrous practices, the abominable practices that they were guilty of, for which sake the very land vomited out the people, those were the things they were not to be doing. And Israel followed in the path of the idolatrous nations around them. They learned to worship the gods of the east. They learned to worship the gods up to the north in Sidon. As we saw this morning, Jezebel brought in Baal worship into the nation of Israel. They followed the practices of the Egyptians. It's probably that whole matter of the weeping of Tammuz. Maybe that was an Egyptian practice, it's thought. And so they're bringing Egyptian practices in, and probably also Babylonian practices as well, at least worshiping the sun to the east. So you have all the nations represented by the idolatrous acts that the people were giving themselves over to. The first of the episodes takes place as he's told to lift up his eyes to the north in verse 5. He does this. He sees the north at the altar gate in the north, at the entrance. And that is to enter into the temple precinct, as you enter into the outer courts. He's told to see what they're doing. See the great abomination that the house of Israel is committing, to drive me far from my sanctuary. He's brought to the entrance of the court in verse 7. I'm sorry, that's the next episode. But it was this matter of the image that's spoken of in verse 4. There was an image of jealousy. There was an image that provokes God to jealousy. Remember, the Lord said, not to make unto you any graven image of things in heaven, of things in earth, of things that are under the earth. It says, for I, the Lord, am a jealous God. God would be worshipped in the purity of who he is and not have any visible representation of himself. And now right in the court of the sanctuary itself, they brought in an image. An image that does provoke the jealous God to wrath against his people. There's all manner of speculations as to exactly what that image is. Perhaps thought that it was some form of an Asherah totem pole, which would have been a female god that's associated with male worship. This is possibly some Canaanite practice that they brought right into the precinct of the temple itself. And so that's the first thing. And Ezekiel is brought to see this image that was placed within the outer courts that provokes the Lord to jealousy, for which reason God says he is driven far from his sanctuary. The second thing, he's brought into the entrance of the court, moving further into the holy space, spaces that the temple provided. And he comes to the wall of the temple itself and holds it a hole that's in the wall. How that hole was made or who made it is simply not told. It just was there. And he's instructed to dig in the wall. I'm not told exactly what he used to dig into the wall, but he does. Maybe it was his hands, maybe something else. But again, this is a vision. So the wall itself gave way rather readily. As a vision, he's coming to dig in obedience to what he's commanded to do. And then what happens as he digs into the hole is he sees that there's an entrance. You wonder why he didn't just go in by the door, but he's not going by the door. Because you see, he's going to see a dark room. He's going to see the things that the people of Israel do in dark places, the things that they think no one else will see. And yet God's eye is ever upon what they are doing. He's told to go in and see the vile abominations that they are committing here. And so he went in and he saw. I guess his eyes had to adjust to the dark circumstances, the dark situation. And then he looks around and he sees that on the wall there's these engravings. Not only do you have an image out in the court, but you have images engraved upon the walls. Now there were some engravings that God commanded to be placed into certain of the furniture of the temple. But these were images that were not to be engraved at all. This was every form of creeping thing and loathsome beasts, and all the idols of the house of Israel were represented in these engravings. There were unclean animals that were engraved upon the walls of God's temple. There were things that the Gentiles worshipped, that the nations worshipped, probably practices that were found amongst, particularly the Assyrians, maybe at this point. It's hard to know. We don't know this definitively, but it's likely practices of again, surrounding nations, whether they were Canaanite practices or Assyrian practices. But this was depicted on the very walls of the temple. And then before them, these images, there stood these 70 men of the elders of the house of Israel. You think of 70 elders, what do you think of? The elders who, his spirit was placed upon those 70 men who helped to rule the nation. And so these were 70 godly men. These were 70 men committed to the Torah, to enacting the law of Israel. But these 70 men were given over to idolatrous worship and idolatrous practices. They're not squawking about what's going on in the temple. They're not squawking about these engravings that are upon the wall, the creeping things and the boots and beasts and men that are being represented. They're leading it. They're leading false worship. They're leading the nation down the path of false worship. Now again, the leaders of the nation would have been taken into captivity long before this, and yet those who came and stood in their place and took leadership in the nation were wholly corrupted men. And then along with them was this guy Jazaniah, who's mentioned in the 11th verse. And we don't know anything about this guy Jazaniah. I don't recall what his name actually meant. It escapes me, and I didn't write it down. But to me, the interesting thing here, he's called the son of Shaphan. The son of Shaphan, who was standing among them. And the thing about the son of Shaphan is that this guy Shaphan is mentioned in the time of the reforms of Josiah. Remember Josiah the king, who brought great reforms to the high places and the idolatrous practices of the nation? Those who were enlisted in helping the work of reform in the days of Josiah were called sons of Shaphan. So Shaphan's family was a good family. These were men who sought to worship God. And now we find even corruption in the household of Shaphan. Other descendants of Shaphan, this guy Jazaniah, who's taking his place among these idolatrous 70 men of the elders of the nation, and leading the nation in idolatrous practice. Each of them, we're told, had a censer in his hand, and the smoke of the cloud of incense went up. And he said to me, "Son of man, have you seen what the elders of the house of Israel are doing in the dark? Each in his room of pictures, upon the wall, the images of their own heart, not the truth of God, not the truth of who God is." And what was their excuse for doing this? How did they justify doing this in the very house of God? Well, the answer to that is their words that are quoted in the 12th verse, the end of the 12th verse, for they say, "Yahweh does not see us. Yahweh does not see us." There's no penalty to be paid for these things we're doing. Yahweh hasn't heard our cries. He hasn't come to our relief. Our nation is in distress, so let's go after the Assyrian gods that used to help the Assyrians out so well. Let's go after the Babylonian gods that seem to be helping them. The gods of the Canaanites that seem to be helping them. We'll cover all of our bases and have a religion that calls upon whatever gods we choose, whatever gods suit us. They're doing it in the dark. Each in his room of pictures, imagining God as they desire him to be. And they say, "Yahweh doesn't care. Yahweh's not involved in this. Yahweh doesn't see. Yahweh won't answer. Yahweh's forsaken the land. You can't expect him to come back and judge the land." It's exactly what Yahweh's going to do. And that's their excuse. Total unbelief, total compromise, total departure from the God of Israel, total commitment to God's of the land. And Ezekiel's told, you will still see greater abominations that they will commit. And then we move to the entrance of the north gate in verse 14, again taking this tour around the different areas of the temple region. And there you behold in the place where the women gathered, what do you find? Well, you find weeping women. And what are the women weeping for? Well, we're not told. We're told it's Tammuz. And again, I don't think there's an acceptable solutions to exactly what Tammuz means. But it's likely, in the fact that they're weeping, there's some sort of mourning that's going on for the dead. That's a very pagan practice, and we're told this is an abomination, so weeping connected with the dead, that'd be a probable idea of what's going on here. And again, we're not to be communing with the dead. We're not to be looking for mediums and those who would be worshiping the dead or having any type of communion with the dead. And here these women are engaged in that very sort of practice. And he said to me, "Have you seen this? O son of man, you'll see greater abominations than these." And then the final abomination, which Ezekiel is shown, is as he's brought into the inner court of the house of Yahweh, the place where the priest came to offer incense unto God, the place where the menorah lamps were lit, the place where the showbread was displayed. They came into that very area of holy space in the temple of the Lord, between the porch and the altar. It's hard to know if it's the altar of burnt offering or the altar of incense. And there were 25 men involved in this activity. So there were elders, there were women, there were just plain old men, all kinds of people that are engaged in these idolatrous actions in the temple precincts. And these 25 men, and look at how they're poised. They're poised with their backs to the temple of Yahweh, and their faces are toward the east, and they're worshiping the sun in the east. Remember, the entrance to the temple was eastward. That's where they entered the temple. And now they're turning their backs to that eastern entrance, and they're looking east to the sunrise, and they're worshiping the sun toward the east. And then he said to me, "Have you seen this? O son of man, it's too light a thing for the house of Judah to commit the abominations they commit here." It doesn't stop there. It doesn't stop there. I mean, this is horrific enough. If you have any sensibility for the honor of Israel's God, any sensibility about the purity of his worship, the way God instituted his worship in Israel, you'd be filled with a sense of outrage. But folks, it never simply ends with religious sins. Religious sins fall out from that apostasy from God himself to all manner of iniquity that people commit in all of their relationships of life. Their social sins, their sins against other people. It says here that they should fill the land with violence and provoke me to further anger still. It's interesting how in the words of the prophets you find the connection so intimately made between apostasy from Yahweh and every manner of evil that human beings commit against one another. You think of chapter 2 of the prophecy of Isaiah, and you see how the people were guilty of the similar compromise that you find in Israel with foreign gods and foreign ideas and traditions. And it says in verse 6 that you have rejected your people, the house of Jacob, because they're full of things from the east. They have their practices of worship that come from foreign nations. And again, in the east you have the Babylonians, you have the Assyrians, fortune tellers like the Philistines were told, and the Philistines were to the west. They strike their hands with the children of foreigners. Their land is filled with silver and gold. They're given over to materialistic pursuits. There's no end to their treasures. Their land is filled with horses. And that's their military might. Their concern is to amass for themselves wealth, to amass for themselves treasures, to amass for themselves the machinery of war, to multiply horses and armaments and the rest. There's no end to their chariots, we're told. But the land is not only filled with idolatrous pursuit of wealth and the idolatrous pursuit of power. It's just simply their land is filled with idols in general, every kind of idols. Verse 8, they bow down to the work of their hands, to what their own fingers have made. That's what the idols of men are. They're things we concoct for ourselves. Things we make out of our own fingers, or even out of our own minds, and make them to be as if they were gods. And all manner of iniquity comes in the relationship that people have with one another in terms of iniquitous pursuits. Chapter 5 details some of it. In the pursuit for wealth, they're taking property that doesn't belong to them, seeking to add land to land and house to house, and seeking to acquire acquisitions for themselves. In their pursuit of power, they're exploiting the poor. They're oppressing the needy. They're guilty of bilking their workers and not paying them. They're guilty of all kinds of iniquitous actions. And long rooted in their apostasy from God. If they feared the Lord, they would keep his ways. They'd walk in his statutes. They'd seek the things that pertain to righteousness. So unrighteousness and ungodliness go hand in hand. There is no devotion to the true living God. There's no commitment to righteousness. Anything goes. You simply say, the Lord doesn't see, the Lord doesn't avenge, the Lord doesn't care. We live as we see fit. There's no fear of God before their eyes. Then, at the end of the 8th chapter, they said that they put the branch to their nose. And again, the image is hard to understand. It could be the branch is placed to God's nose. Again, in a place where worship endeavors to bring incense offerings unto the Lord, they're just bringing offensive actions in the presence of the Lord and not seeming to care. And even if they would take their branch and stick it in God's eye and say, we don't care what you see. We don't think you care anyway about us. We don't think you see anything anyhow. And we just don't care about what God sees. And we don't care that God breathes in the stench of our iniquity, the stench of our own wickedness and our crimes. It may well be they just simply, in this image, is putting the branch to God's nose, saying, we don't care that you're whether you're pleased or displeased with what we do. We don't care that you you view our actions with the stench of our crimes and sins in your nostrils. Again, it's perhaps an image of just a complete indifference to the God of the covenant. And it's therefore, because of these abominations, abomination upon abomination upon abomination upon abomination, the Lord says, as he says in chapter 7, I'm going to bring disaster upon disaster upon disaster upon this people. I will act in wrath. My eye will not spare. I will not have pity. Though they cry in my ears with a loud voice, I will not be afraid. Maybe you're saying to yourself, Pastor Gordon, another successful message depressing us to no end. Thanks a lot. Well, again, we need to hear this. We need to hear the reality of what people in the pride of their hearts do. Because we're not made of different stuff. Left to ourselves, we could be just as iniquitous, just as double-dealing, just as blind to God's interests and God's glory, and blind to our own interests and our own good as well. And I think there's some practical lessons we need to have underscored in our minds before, as we consider what Ezekiel saw in this vision of God in the temple in Jerusalem. And the first thing is, there's clearly the dangers of any kind of religious syncretism. So what the role of syncretism? Well, syncretism is simply the attempt to amalgamate or to merge into one a variety of religious ideas and practices. And that's what's going on here. I mean, you'd ask the average Israelite in Jerusalem, are you completely unconcerned about Yahweh? Well, some of them would say what these people were saying, doesn't see, doesn't care, God's forsaken the land, so it really doesn't matter. I'm sure there are the others who would say, well, yeah, well, we still have the memory of Yahweh. We don't want to rule him out completely. I mean, he's a God in some way or fashion, but we're going to cover our bases. And Yahweh hasn't been all that reliable lately in helping us get what it is that we desire. And so what they do is they add religious practices from other places. Other nations have been more successful. Let's worship the gods that they worship. Let's worship the God of the Philistines. Let's worship the God of the Canaanites. Let's worship the God of the Assyrians. Let's worship the God of the Babylonians. And they were bringing in foreign worship when God said, don't. Don't worship the gods of the Canaanites. Don't have anything to do with the religious practices of the Egyptians. They're bringing all of this into Israel. Doing homage. All of the variety of religious ideas and practices. Folks, truth is one. Idolatry is very diverse. True religion is not enhanced by bringing in other interests and ideas and practices. The follies of idolatry are not going to make our religious practices more pleasing to God. Just the opposite. It's not just ancient Israel that is guilty of syncretism. We are guilty too, in the modern church, of amalgamation, of merging into the worship of God, the idols of our modern American culture. And it's done in so many ways. Think of the idol of amusement. A sociologist by the name of Neil Postman wrote a book years ago called Amusing Ourselves to Death. And amusement and entertainment has become the great pursuit of people. This is the age of Las Vegas. This is the age of Atlantic City, of showrooms and casinos and gambling and bright lights and games that people play. Amusement. And the church is compromised at this very point. We want people to feel happy. And we want people to be amused. We want to pander to the idol of entertainment. We want to entertain people rather than instruct them, rather than teach them, rather than proclaim the message of the gospel to them. The church has now become a place in many places where fun is the order of the day and amusement is the great thing that is pursued. I was saying at lunch there's a book that I haven't bought it yet, but the title just intrigued me. It's called The Juvenilization of the Church. And the church has just moved in the direction of trying to make the children of the church the great object of pacification. We want to make our kids pacified. We want to make them happy. We don't want them to squawk or groan. The church is boring. The church is uninteresting. Or I don't get anything from worship. And instead of parents being parents and looking to train their children to know what it is to worship God in spirit and in truth, parents just simply say, oh, poor junior, poor child, I don't mean to put you in a position or a place where you're unhappy for an hour. We'll find a church more interesting. We'll find a church that will pander to you and give you exactly what you want. So they find a church that has children's church, which everything is geared towards the children. And the children never learn what it is to worship God in the public meeting. They never learn to see worship as what it is designed to be. An hour where we are consumed, not with our desires, but an hour where we're consumed with God's desires. We're endeavoring to worship Him in spirit and in truth, and not just stroke our own desire for an hour of good cheer. Think of the idol of health that people pursue. People were told, you come to Christ, you worship Christ, He's concerned that you should be healthy. He's concerned with healing you. He's concerned with making you well, making you psychologically well-adjusted, giving you a life of just basic ease and happiness, long years, and just taking away any of the realities of living in a fallen world. Wealth, God, that's pursued along with health. People were told if you worship the Lord and you follow biblical principles and you endeavor to be faithful, especially if you endeavor to give to the church and give to His ministries, God's going to bless you real good. He's going to prosper you in abundance. And He's going to cause wealth to overflow to you and make you wealthy. Think of the idol of youth. We've already said something about that. But the church is simply pandering to the youth. And having youth is the great end of how ministry is carried out. Give the kids the music they like. Give the kids to be the ones that we speak to so that we never challenge anybody to think anything more than what a fourth grader would be interested in. Now, I'm fine to talk to fourth graders from time to time. I'm fine to minister to the needs of children. But I think we need to be pursuing things a little bit higher, a little bit more. Again, the Bible's not written at a fourth grade level, folks. Just simply not. We're kidding ourselves to think that it is. Think of the idol of family. We have churches now call themselves the family church, and everything is consumed with family ministries and family interests and family concerns. God wants you to have a great family. I'm all for great families. And I'm all for having biblically well-ordered families. But I know that it's not families that really determine obedience to Christ. There are some times where you have to sacrifice the will of your wife or your husband in order to pursue faithfulness to Christ. When your husband or wife wants you to do something that's untoward, ungodly, and principled, you dig in your heels and you say no. You don't say, well, you're supposed to submit, so just go along with whatever they want, or go along with whatever your children want. So many areas where the modern quest for amusement and health and wealth and youth and family and success is another thing. Is that we need to follow a path that's going to lead us to success. That the people of the world come into the church and say, oh, this is a successful enterprise. Look, all the pews are filled. Look at all of the people that are happy. And look at all the money that's being taken in. And to have this aura of success, I tell you folks, it's just buying into the idols that the world is worshiping. Idols that in and of themselves will not survive the judgment, and failing to give due place, central place, to the God of the covenant, the God of the people of the covenant. Anything that vies for the honors that belong to Jesus Christ alone, anything that's made equal to Him in our love, in our affection, in our attention, in our allegiance, in our obedience, is idolatry, plain and simple. These are the things that God says people do that lead me to abandon them. Just lead me to leave them. We can have all these things and not have God. I'd rather have none of them and have God smack dab central to the life of our assembly. Little in the way of amusement, little in the way of health, little in the way of wealth, little in the way of success. If we have families that hate us because we don't march to their tune, well and good. If we have the smile of heaven, we have a God who is not grieved and pleased with our commitment to Him that's uncompromised, then it will be well with us and well with our assembly. And then I think another thing that needs to be said, not only is it the danger of syncretism that we have exposed in the passage, but I think also, you see how idolatry tends to make its inroads in aggressive ways in the church. I think that's pointed out by the fact that Ezekiel's taken first to the outer courts, he's taken to the northern gate, and there's abominations taking place there. Well, how did it get there? Well, again, it's outside of the gates of the sacred place that funny stuff has gone on with one of the high places. And there was false worship that was taking place in the high places, and that was tolerated. What never remains out there in the high places, it comes into the church. Don't think you're going to make a refuge for yourself in the church if in the place of work you compromise with the law of God. If in the place of your home, you're compromising with the law of God. Don't say, well, I go to the right church, even though I don't bring biblical principles to bear upon all of life. The nation of Israel made their compromises outwardly in the high places. And you see how it works its way in. Gets in the northern gate, and they put up the image that is abomination. Then they allow them to come into the inner rooms where the walls are now plastered with images. They're just the folly of people's imaginations and of their own minds. Pretty much before long, it begins to take up the whole of holy space. And they're right in the holy place itself, turning their backs on it and worshiping the sun. Sin is aggressive, and it's also all-consuming. It intensifies in its gravity. It moves from what's bad to worse. It never simply remains where it is. And we think we could just handle sin. We can harness sin. We can put gates around it. the walls around it so it doesn't go any further. It rarely ever does that. It breaks down those walls that we would put around it, because sin gets what it can get and then seeks more. The writer of the Hebrews speaks about deceitfulness of sin. Sin is a deceitful character, utter lying to us, never shielding its true intentions. It says, give me a little bit. Just give me a little space in your mind. Give me a little bit of your heart. Give me a little bit of your time. Give me a little bit of your attention. I don't want any more. And then he captures that bit that you get to it. And then it works on me more and more and more and more. Hear the words of Ezekiel. There's still a greater body than it means. Doesn't stop at any point. It just moves on. Greater and greater compromise, greater and greater inroads that sin makes into the life of the people of God. And then the final thing this passage really does set out to us is that religious apostasy and moral evil go hand in hand. It's our relationship to God that really does determine our relationship to others. It's having integrity before God, having the fear of God in our hearts, that will determine the way we relate to other people in our business dealings, in our personal relationships, in our marriages. There's no such thing as religious truth and moral truth independent of one another. You cannot say, as the elders said in the temple, God does not see. Once you do that, there's few things that you will not be willing to go. Once you cast off godly fear, once you say God doesn't see and God doesn't care and God's abandoned us anyway, then anything goes. Then anything goes. There'll be complete abandonment to sin. And may God be pleased to give us understand from this passage of Scripture that idolatry is a great evil. A great evil to run from. Not to give ourselves in any way over to any kind of amalgamation of the worship of God and the worship of any other thing. And let us be aware that idolatry will always be aggressive in the inroads it makes, and let us be aware that idolatry will make its presence known in all of life's relationships. And may the Lord be pleased to sober us. May the Lord be pleased also to encourage us to know the God before Him. Very simple command, but yet a very vital command. The first command of the law. May God help us to have Him supremely enshrined in our hearts. Of God, to us is all in all. Let's go before Him in prayer. Father, we are thankful for this Lord's Day. We're thankful for the privilege of coming aside from the world and its concerns, even the legitimate concerns we have as we labor in this world to Your glory. We could have a day of worship, a day of service to You, a day of honoring You, a day of drawing near to You, a day of trafficking in the things of Your Word. Be pleased to bless us as we depart from one another. Encourage our hearts as we go seek to serve You throughout another week. We ask You to hear our prayers. We ask You to be our helper as we come to You in Christ's name. Amen.